Hey, this is Trey Romano, and you're listening to Stargirl After Show.
This is the Stargirl After Show with Sarah and Sean. Your post-show breakdown of DC Stargirl with Easter eggs, exclusive behind-the-scenes info, and cast and crew interviews.
This is our destiny.
I finally know who I really am.
I'm Stargirl.
This is the Stargirl After Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to Stargirl After Show, sponsored as always by Stargirl.tv and DCTV.news, your best resources for news, media, and spoilers about Stargirl and other DC Comics properties. I'm Sean.
And I'm Sarah.
And of course, this week we are going to be talking about this week's episode 203, aka Summer School Chapter 3, with an exclusive interview with Trey Romano, where, of course, as always, we will discuss stuff that probably other interviewers haven't ever asked him. But before we jump into the episode, Sarah, we have some listener mail that I want to read off.
Oh, that's great.
First, we have a message from Abby Frisco. Honestly, overdue. She sent this a while back, but let's read it in. It says, "Hi, Sean and Sarah. Just wanted to pop in and say how much I enjoy the podcast." Thank you very much.
Thank you.
"All the interviews with the cast and crew are so fun and informative, and I love that it's not just cast, but with different crew members from different departments. As a filmmaker myself, I love getting to hear behind the scenes and getting insight into the filmmaking process." And then she asks, "How I have time to run this show while also working on the show." And I don't know. They both take a lot of my time.
It does help that you're not currently filming while you're doing the podcast.
That is true. Not this show anyway, but you know, I do work on the podcast right while working on other productions, and it's problematic. Anyway, she says that she's followed all the DC shows and the Arrowverse since its beginning, as have I. I think we all have.
Mm-hmm.
And Stargirl is one of her favorites. "Thank you so much for this content, for this podcast and the content you deliver." And then she says that she would like to know how I got into the industry and what led me to work on Stargirl, which I think we'll have to cover at another time, because there's yep. kind of a lot to get to in this episode, and I want to do that. But, Abby, thank you so much for your email, and we will touch base back on that. I'll fill it in. In the meantime, I do talk about that a little bit on the Fake Doctors Real Friends podcast, episode 420, if you want to give that a listen. But we will get back to it here anyway. Also, we got an email from Megan, and she said, "I love listening to your podcast every week and have a couple of questions. One, a lot of Courtney's jackets in season one have stars on them. Are they supposed to be a subtle way of showing that she's Stargirl?" Yes. All the costumes have sort of little hints of the secret identities in them throughout the show. You'll see that all of Meg's clothes are black with hints of green, to allude to her being Shiv. Courtney's got the stars, as mentioned.
Pat's got stripes.
Pat wears stripes a lot, often like some red and white, like plaidish stuff as well. You'll see that. If you look at all the characters, they always have little hints of their superhero background in their civilian clothing. It's just one of the subtle little nods that they do to sort of reinforce who each character is, or, you know, it's just visually interesting. Her second question is, in Shiv Part 1, Mike says to Courtney that he and Pat have been through more than she knows. Do you think it may have something to do with Mike's mom? And do you think we'll find out in season 2? I don't really have any idea specifically what he was referring to, and we'll have to wait and see if we're going to see it in season 2. What do you think, Sarah?
I think with Sylvester making his appearance and talking with the woman at the diner about her ex-husband, I'm thinking that we're going to learn more about their history, especially with how prominent Mike is being in this episode and then just in the season in general.
And that's our listener mail. Please feel free to send us questions. We will address them here as best we can. And on that costumes question, I actually have a note about that for this episode. So unless there's anything else you'd like to bring up, Sarah, I'm ready to jump in.
Oh, I'm ready to go in too.
Warning, spoilers ahead for this week's episode.
All right, so we jump in 11 years ago, Christmas. We have the same music that's been playing for all the Christmas flashbacks. I really like how that ties in. This is that day. We know this is a day that the JSA is defeated. But it's Pat working on his car, and then Johnny comes in a fantastic green suit and talking about how he's been benched for this battle.
Also want to bring up, this is Ethan Embry playing Johnny Thunder, who's an actor that I have loved since the 90s. I think the first thing I saw him in was Empire Records, where he plays Mark, the lovable stoner who's into Guar. So great to see this actor in this role and to see Johnny Thunder on screen at all.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Also want to point out, we get some shots of some scenery here to establish, you know, this is Pat's garage at JSA headquarters. And we've got the Seven Soldiers of Victory photo that we established last season. We get the Star-Spangled Kid defeats Dr. Weird newspaper clipping from last season, and then a couple other newspaper clippings. And there are more yet here that we haven't seen in this scene, but we may see them later on in the season. Unclear. I want to say like 9 different newspaper covers.
Oh, wow. Were you given a lot of direction on them?
Oh, yes. Yes. It was a thing where I was back and forth with the production designer, who was back and forth with Jeff and James, mm-hmm. sort of like filtering the info back and forth, doing notes. I was up till, I think, 2:30 in the morning one night getting these all designed. Also want to point out the Star-Spangled Kid uniform in the case, mm-hmm. and the stripesy uniform, and my JSA seal that I designed last season that never got used.
Oh, yay.
Last season, it was the thing I was the most excited to design. I got hired on the show and I was like, I'm going to get to design a JSA logo. And then it didn't get used last season, even though we made it. But here it is now, the official JSA logo for Stargirl. I'm very happy.
Yeah, it looked awesome.
Thank you.
And in this scene, I also like talking about the decor. There's like the themed little Merry Christmas mugs and stuff. And I just think it's cute that Stripesy takes the time to go out and purchase that stuff and then decorate the place to make everything feel like home. Because yeah. I'm assuming it was Stripesy doing that.
Hey, a Christmas lights up.
And then we get a little bit of foreshadowing here where Johnny and Pat are talking about being benched and how, you know, Johnny feels like a charity case on the team and, you know, and Pat trusts what Sylvester wants for him and all that. But they're also talking about how it doesn't feel good to be, you know, benched in the big fight.
Yeah, he mentions that on paper, the Thunderbolt is more powerful than Green Lantern, Flash, and all of them combined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Wildcat comes and gets Johnny because Solomon Grundy's there, and so they need more help, and Pat's all ready to jump in, but no, Sylvester said specifically, you have a kid to worry about, like you need to stay behind.
I want to point out though that this is actually our first time hearing Wildcat speak, mm-hmm. because all we saw of him before was hitting the ground when he got thrown out of the mansion and then just falling unconscious.
Was it the same actor?
Yes. It was Brian okay. Stapf. So good to have him like getting some dialogue, and Johnny saying like, when I get back, we'll have that eggnog, was a little bit heartbreaking.
Yeah, I know.
You know, when we know how that has all ended.
Mm-hmm.
And what a great way to like do that too, to just like flashback to right before the pilot starts and sort of see this lead in.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I also wonder about, like, how close was it that Wildcat was able to run back in person to be like, hey, Johnny, we need your help.
Yeah, I did think about, like, why wasn't that a phone call?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's more dynamic to have one of the other heroes come in and say, like, we need backup.
Yeah, that's true. All right. And then we go on and Mike is on his paper route. And I thought it was interesting that some of his throws were just perfect, landed right on the stoop, and the other throws ended up in the bird bath or on the roof. And it's like, you know, he could be really good if he took the time, but he just doesn't care.
You know, honestly, I think maybe those might be customers that are not very nice.
Oh, so you think he's doing that on purpose? Okay.
Because the roof throw, that paper landed amongst other papers on the
roof. Yeah, that's true.
So that seems like that's his spot for that particular paper.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't know, though.
He runs into some bullies on Buttercup Lane there. Do you know, is there any meaning behind Buttercup?
I couldn't find any meaning behind Buttercup Lane.
Unfortunately, Mike is getting beat up by these guys. And, you know, I'm getting the impression that it's not the first time that this happened. But he does keep his, like, sassy attitude with them. So I did like that about Mike.
Love it.
And then back at the Dugan Whitmore home, Courtney's already celebrating, you know, their victory, that she just knows that they're going to beat the Shade. And Pat's cautioning her, you know, don't count your chickens before they hatch here. Come on. I love how Barbara's like, you know, okay, well, Stripe needs to go put like an invisibility mode on it or something. And I just think it's really cute how hard she's trying there.
Yeah, I love her trying to strategize. And Courtney's just like, Mom, come on, leave this to the pros. Mm-hmm. The pros. Okay, yeah. Courtney. Okay.
And then Mike comes in, you know, shirt torn, all beat up, and no one says a thing.
Yeah, no one notices. And they just sort of brush him off.
Yeah, I think the fact that they are still talking to him and don't notice, I think that's even harsher than if they just ignored him altogether.
I mean, they're preoccupied in their defense.
Yes.
But Mike's 15 years old. You know, he's not going to, like, really, you know, understand that.
Right.
He's in a very emotional period of his life.
Yes. I did like that Courtney actually, like, showed him, like, these are the papers, but then she did quickly take them away. So I feel like she was attempting to bring him into it. But then Mike gets a call from his boss about another customer, and he's like, you know, just give it to Joaquim, that he'll be in better hands if you do that.
Yeah, and that was a really nice setup for the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
The exact phrase, better hands.
And his pen doesn't work, but he goes into Courtney's room and finds this nice, lovely pink pen. And that one works to write with. And so he's able to get the information and go on his way.
And so then we get the so cool montage where he just starts seeing the words so cool everywhere. Mm-hmm. Street signs, dude's jogging shirt, the newspapers that he's carrying even.
Yeah, so he crashes his bike and looks at the paper and he's just like, so cool. And then all of a sudden we get Jim Gaffigan. I mean, the Thunderbolt. But he shows up and I don't know. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and it's worth noting about this Thunderbolt here that we've got sort of an amalgamation of different versions of the Thunderbolt.
Oh, yeah.
Because he mentions that his homeland is the country of Bodnesia.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the golden age version of the Thunderbolt. Post-crisis, he's from the fifth dimension, the same place Mixia's Piddalek comes from. And in the golden age, you know, the genie had like a family. He had a genie wife named Mildred and a genie son and a whole extended genie family. And that's clearly not this version. This would be the Yuze version of the Thunderbolt, should be his real name, Yuze.
I wonder, with him talking about how alone he feels and all that, if maybe there was a family and kid and that's gone now. I wonder if we'll get into that in
or
the
maybe
future.
Maybe there never mm-hmm. was. That's why he's lonely.
Yeah.
He never had it at all.
Yeah, that could be.
And then, of course, Mike is going to start wishing right away, because why wouldn't
right.
you? And he immediately runs into some genie rules.
Yeah, we get a lot of kind of an info dump, but I like how they did it here, where we get the, you got to be specific, you know, so Mike's soaked from the water he wanted. He wanted it in a glass, but, you know, he didn't ask for it properly. And then, so he can't wish for the same thing twice. He can't wish to...
Now, I got to say, I love the not wishing for the same thing twice thing. Mm-hmm. So, like, the longer you use this power, the more limited it becomes.
That's really interesting, yeah.
Imagine how limited Johnny Thunder must have been by the time he died mm-hmm. 11 years ago.
Yeah. And then I feel like something that could be pretty important is he talks about some more rules, or you can't wish someone dead, and then you can't wish someone back from the dead. And then he starts kind of mumbling, being like, well, that was super important because, you know, the last time, and then Mike cuts him off. So I'm like, okay, well, that could be leading up to something that actually is of something important. And then we go over to the pit stop, and Pat and Courtney are kind of giving the rundown on the Shade. And Courtney is very proud of herself.
And Rick has just returned from feeding Grundy.
Yes, but he tells them that there was a dog. And Yolanda's even like, when did you get a dog? And we learn about the Shade that Pat believes that he doesn't age and that his power is shadows.
And there are photos of him going back to the 1800s.
Yes.
It's all very much in keeping with the Shade from the comics.
Yes, but Pat only has the one single photo of him, and that's right in the middle of the whiteboard. I just like that visual look of it, that they know nothing. Like, they literally have one thing that they know about him.
And you can't see his face. What you can see is his cane and his watch, the watch that Pat clocked in the diner. Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of trying to figure out what to do here. Beth, you know, Pat tells them that the Shade is who killed Dr. Midnight. And so Beth very desperately wants to get justice for him. Rick's kind of looking at it more practically, which I like this about Rick. I feel like we're getting a lot of progress with him, that he's not just like, all right, let's rush into the fight. He's like, well, how do we punch a shadow? Like, we need to know things.
And I love Courtney's deferment to Pat on these things.
Yes.
Like, she's not just like throwing out whatever impetuous ideas she has. She's like, well, Pat, you're the expert. How do we punch a shadow? Mm-hmm. You know, Pat's response is exactly what Courtney hoped to hear.
Yes. Yeah, that she gets to use the staff to incapacitate him. But then what? They don't know yet.
I do like the plan they eventually come up with, but we'll get
yes.
there.
And then we go over to Barbara, and so she's down in Zarek's unit doing inventory. She tells Swift when he shows up, just kind of appears from the shadows. And then somehow he got her phone claiming that she had dropped it, and it was, you know, magically dead.
Now, here's a little behind the scenes thing about the phone that I want to point out. Barbara usually uses an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Because Apple provides phones and computers and stuff to TV shows to use free of charge, they have certain rules about them. So, for example, on a TV show, you'll almost never see a bad guy using an iPhone.
Oh, really?
They don't want their brand affiliated with evil, you know?
Right.
And because this phone doesn't work, even though it's clearly the Shade doing something to it, it's not the actual phone malfunctioning, the prop master decided to play it safe and not use an iPhone.
Oh, okay.
So you'll see there's like a barcode on the back of her phone.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with it's a barcode because this is her work phone and it's property of the American Dream.
Oh, which okay.
It actually says back, this says property of the American Dream with a barcode and a serial number. You can't really read it because it's a dark storage mm-hmm. unit. But that's why she's not using her normal phone there, because out of an abundance of caution, we didn't want Apple to get mad at us.
That makes sense.
For like, oh, you know, technology, it always fails you when you need it the most.
Mm-hmm.
I thought someone might find that interesting. So there you go, guys.
Yeah, I had no idea.
And that'll keep someone from, you know, saying like, oh, that's not the phone she normally uses. Mm-hmm. No, it's not, because that's her work phone.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So looking around, Swift ends up taking an empty box, which we recognize as the box that formerly held the Black Diamond that Shiv already took.
The one that Cindy already got to last season. Yeah.
And he seems a little bit put out.
Can I also point out, I love, because this is, the storage unit is filled with stuff from Zarek's political career, but also his magic career.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that there's a coffin in there.
Yes. I was wondering about that too. But I was chalking it up to
clearly just
a prop.
Yeah, one of his magic props. I have no additional information on that. I just noticed it and I liked it.
So Swift ends up taking the box, even though Barbara is very strongly encouraging him not to do it and trying to insist.
She asserts herself very well, especially given that she actually knows who this is.
Yeah. I was thinking if I was in her shoes, well, I probably would have run away, you know, as soon as he showed up. But
oh, yeah.
You know, I probably would have been like, okay, that's fine. Go ahead and take it. You know, I don't want to piss him off.
Her response could be definitely nothing too extraordinary if she were ignorant as to who he really was.
Yes.
But given her knowledge, her assertiveness is remarkable.
And I love that because it shows where Courtney gets it from. And so Courtney's attitude makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. And I just generally love Barbara being a part of the team in some mm-hmm. way. It's so much better than this whole like keeping your loved ones in the dark thing that most superhero shows have. And that, you know, in the case of Barbara, this show had for the first 6 or 7 episodes of season 1.
Yeah. I think this flows a lot better now. Like I understand the need for it. But it's just so much easier to not keep secrets.
It's so much easier to not keep secrets, and it allows you new ways of telling the story because it just gets old when you're watching story after story where someone can't explain what's going on because, mm-hmm. you know, their identity is a secret from the ones they love.
All right. And then we are over at summer school again with history class, and Yolanda starts getting a really bad headache again. And Courtney's asking about it. So it sounds like this is happening fairly often.
We're seeing here that Yolanda is very much worried about having to kill again.
Yes. And she says she won't do it again. And Courtney is trying to like comfort her and saying, it's not going to come to that. I won't put you in that position.
Which is a very strange thing for a teenage girl to have to assure another teenage girl mm-hmm. of. I promise you, you're not going to have to murder anybody again.
Yeah, and they aren't being very quiet about it. And Isaac definitely heard that they were talking about the shade.
It is worth noting that Courtney has had time to study with no supervillains in Blue Valley.
Yes, I did really like that. History is actually pretty easy when you read the book.
R.I.P. Aztecs.
Yes. All right, so now we go back to Mike on his route, and the bullies are back, but now they're picking on a tiny little Girl Scout and being bigger jerks. I do really like how Mike is like, you know, this is a new low for them, and he wants to stand up and, you know, protect that little girl. You know, they just stole her cookies. Well, that money's coming out of the little girl's pocket. Like,
and I love her not backing down.
Yes.
She's like, I'm not giving you free cookies.
Yeah.
So they have to grab them and run off. They basically ran away from a Girl Scout.
Yes, exactly.
Because that's what bullies are. They're guys that run away from Girl Scouts.
So Mike makes his first superhero wish that he wishes that they would stop.
And so Mike needs to take a cue from Courtney here and study. Maybe he could look up the word specific. First thing the Thunderbolt says to him is, you got to be specific with the wishes. So, Thunderbolt, I wish you would stop them. Come on, Mike. Come on.
Yeah, and I just love the idea that the Thunderbolt is like, oh, I have so much freedom now. I can do whatever I want. And so stop signs start raining from the sky. And and Mike's like, oh, that's great. You know, look, you really scared them.
But it accomplished nothing. They didn't exactly like go give the cookies back.
No, they still got away. But I guess they got distracted once Courtney and Yolanda showed up. And Mike introduces himself as the newest member of the JSA. And the Thunderbolt was like, no, we are. I like that. I really like the Thunderbolt. I'm really excited. I hope he sticks around a lot more.
I'm loving Jim Gaffigan in this role.
And if I remember from when we talked to Breck between seasons, Jim Gaffigan was never on set or anything, right? He just did the recording.
That is correct. It is actually Mr. Diesinger doing the on-set performance of the Thunderbolt's voice for Trey to react to, which we discuss in the interview.
All right, so we return to the pit stop, and Pat is really mad at Courtney because she didn't tell him that she took the pen, and she was like, I honestly forgot about it. She had clicked it, and nothing happened, so she put it away. Like,
yeah, it's a pen.
Yeah.
But going back to our listener's question about Courtney's costuming with the stars, you'll notice Mike is still dressed in his typical look for this episode, but the shirt that he's wearing is now a bright green, much like Johnny Thunder wore.
Yes.
So it's like he's still dressed like Mike, but in colors that reference Johnny Thunder. And that's the exact kind of thing that they do. And I would not expect to see Mike wearing this particular shirt again after this episode, given that, you know, beyond this episode, he no longer possesses the Thunderbolt.
And I also like that it looked a little bit oversized. Like, he doesn't quite fit into this yet. You know, he has a little ways to go before he fully fills out that role.
Which he won't, because he wished it away at the end.
Right. I mean, the role at the JSA.
Which, you know, hopefully that is a role that does materialize for him. Because it's sort of the family business now.
Yeah, and I'm getting real worried with how much he is feeling pushed away, because Cindy has him on her list to start recruiting. So we'll see.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned that my wife has predicted that he's going to be evil.
And then the rest of the team is very excited that they might have a genie on board. And Beth is like, well, maybe he can fix the goggles. And Rick is like, maybe he can find the shade. But Pat is very adamant that this guy's nothing but trouble. We don't want him around.
And when he said he would just mess everything up, Mike assumed he was talking about him.
Yes.
Like, me? No, not you. The Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
That's just such a good illustration of Mike's insecurities being on the outside of this team and everything, where Pat almost can't say anything innocuously enough without Mike taking some offense to it.
But I do like that Mike has enough respect for Pat that he is trying to give him the pen back. Like, he listens and he's trying to give it to him, but the Thunderbolt's not having it. And every time he hands it to him, just flies right back. And so Pat goes to talk to the Thunderbolt alone.
Yeah. I love how excited the Thunderbolt is about Stripe.
Mm-hmm. And I really like their dynamic, because now I'm thinking that, you know, the Thunderbolt sometimes would just pop out of the pen and hang out with them, with the rest of the team, and not only be called out for battle.
Yeah, he was in the JSA photo, you know, so he came out for that. It is worth noting that in the early days of the Thunderbolt's appearances in the comics, he did not make himself known. And Johnny Thunder, for quite a long time, thought that all the stuff that was happening around him due to the Thunderbolt was like his own innate power.
Oh, yeah.
And we see a lot of that in this, where the Thunderbolt is just in the pen and making stuff happen. He wasn't out when the stop sign stuff was going on, or, you know, when Mike did his taller wish or any of that. He was just in the pen, much like it was back then. But, you know, Johnny Thunder in the early days literally just thought it was him and didn't even realize that his use of the phrase "say you" had anything to do with his superheroics.
Yeah, that's...
He was a little slow on the uptake.
Yeah, that must have been a rough realization once he figured out, or once the Thunderbolt appeared.
I mean, he was probably still excited.
Probably. I would be. All right, so Pat goes to, while he's talking to the Thunderbolt, they talk about Johnny. He's like, you know, even with all your power, Johnny still died. And so you can see that's like the root of why Pat is so adamant that he doesn't want Mike to have it.
And it goes back to what Johnny was saying in the flashback, where, you know, this is so powerful, but in my hands, it's just another mess for the JSA to clean up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, someone who had years, potentially decades, given the weird time frames we're dealing with on this show.
Yeah.
That are still a mystery. But potentially decades to master use of the pen. And right up until the end, he was sidelined as much as they could do so.
And then we learn that Johnny had one last wish for the Thunderbolt. Right before he died, he wished that he would find a new friend.
In 11 years.
Yes.
Apparently.
Yes. So he wasn't specific as to when he needed to find one. So he waited, Thunderbolt waited for the right time and had to find someone who was just like him, completely and utterly alone.
Which I think it's probably more a case that in the moment that Mike got a hold of the pen, he was feeling totally alone. So that was immediately after nobody noticed that he had been beaten up and his shirt was ripped. He probably doesn't always feel alone.
No, probably not.
But that was the window in which the Thunderbolt could, latch onto him as host.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's face it, if you have a genie in your pocket, you're not going to feel alone forever,
Right, yeah.
You always have a friend you can just so cool into existence.
Yes. I gotta say, I love that you're recording this episode while holding the pen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got some, so I may as well.
Yeah.
You know what? Maybe we should give some away. How about the first 10 people to get onto Twitter, tag at StarGirlPod, and say, so cool, we'll get a pink pen. I will ship it to you at my own cost. Yeah, go do that. This is going to be fun.
Stargirl After Show.
So what would happen if four friends from Best Buy decided to create the greatest podcast in the world? You would get Underground Nerd Nation, of course. We mainly talk about topics related to nerd culture and pop culture. But you never know where our conversations may take us. Like the time we got in a debate over grading scales. You're bound to have a good time with Underground Nerd Nation. So come join the Underground. We got beer and pizza down here.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Stargirl After Show.
Okay, so while Pat is talking to the Thunderbolt, Courtney goes out to talk to Mike outside. And he's like, so am I in? You're the GSA leader. What you say goes. And she's like, well, Pat's your dad. That kind of has bigger veto power than I do. But he just is talking about, think about all the bad guys that we can take down together and all the people we can save together, brother and sister. The Thunderbolt picked me. I'm just like you. And that gets to Courtney. And so she tells Pat, hey, he's in. The whole team's behind it.
Yeah, she says that's veto power I can't overrule. But then she's like, you know what? I'm gonna overrule that veto power.
Yeah, exactly. And so Pat agrees he can help locate the Shade, but that's it. And then we get this great montage of them coming up with all the ideas of how specifically you can make this wish so that the Thunderbolt can't run amok.
And the wish is so long and goes through so many permutations. I did think about freeze framing and seeing if I could read it all. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, because it does change so much. I did notice at one point someone wrote something out, and then rather than just erase it, they wrote, I mean, and corrected themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be stressful to make that wish. And so I can see how in the moment of in a battle, it'd be really hard to come up with a wish that is going to do what you actually want it to do. So it could be very tough to have the Thunderbolt as your power. All right. So now they come up with a wish that will not backfire. And Mike makes a wish and it works. On the little map that they had, there was a little fire that the Thunderbolt put there. And it happened to be right at William Zarek's house.
And it's a good thing that Blue Valley is such a small town, because I'll tell you what, if someone pointed at a dot on a map of Atlanta, I absolutely would not go, well, that's somebody's house.
Right. Yep. I don't think I could do that for St. Louis either.
Yeah. But Blue Valley. Yeah. I think everybody knows where former Councilman William Zarek lived.
Mm-hmm. And so Mike's all like gung ho, like, let's go, let's do this. And Pat reminds him, no, you're staying here. And I love that he says, don't bench me now, because it's a tie back to the beginning there. And you got to wonder if Pat is feeling any of the same, like, I know what you're going through kind of stuff, but he is not relaying it to him if he is.
And I do love that before they put this plan into motion, there's one more step.
They need to get mom's permission.
Exactly. They have to run it past Barb. And this, like, tickled me so much. Just that, like, they're a superhero team planning an offensive against the bad guy. And they have to run it past Barbara and she has to approve.
Yes.
And not just because part of the plan involves using her tanning bed as a prison.
Yes.
Or a holding cell, I guess.
Right. And Courtney knows it and she accepts it. She's like, so was the plan approved? Like, as soon as she sees Pat.
They're all sort of like on team. Let's make sure Barbara's okay with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's pretty much all their moms at this point.
Exactly. Because,
Rick doesn't have any parents. Matt certainly doesn't count.
Nope.
Yolanda's parents don't count because they're just garbage people.
Yep.
Beth's parents are neglectful of her despite her being like super on board with them. Mm-hmm. You know, like she's super daughter and they barely have time for her. So Barbara is the mom for the whole group.
And she does a great job with it.
Yeah, I'm loving her role in this season.
Yes. So she gives her approval and then we see Mike like struggling with being there all alone. And then he starts working on the board to make his own wish.
Yeah. Look, I got to talk about this. First, notice how large the words he was writing were.
Yep.
Compared with the dense paragraphs they had. He's writing these 8-inch high, I wish. That already is not boding well.
No.
And as we see when he finally bursts in, the plan that he came up with, the wish that he came up with, was super weak.
It was. I mean,
the verb was zap.
Yep.
I want you to zap him. What does that mean, Mike? Come on, buddy. Zap? The only specificity he did was he lifted the part about it not being a lampshade or a window shade.
Yes.
Mike, study harder, buddy.
Really.
Put more effort in.
But we're jumping the gun a bit because...
Yeah. I did jump ahead. I apologize.
They're outside the house and talking about how it's now a historic landmark.
And we really need to address our man's poor trash talk.
I loved it. You know, it'll be historic once I get my hands on the shade.
What's that even mean? I don't know. I'm amped up.
I love that. I'm amped. I struggle a lot with Rick last season because he was just so angry and angsty all the time. And I'm really enjoying him now.
Yeah, now he's like, he's not even good at being angry.
No. So my impression of the shade right now is he's not really a bad guy. I think he just wants to do what he wants to do and he's not there to cause trouble. He's just trying to get his mission accomplished.
When he discusses the ISA, he says our interests aligned for a time. That is classic James Robinson shade right there.
Mm-hmm.
When interests align, that's when he makes alliances.
Yes.
In the pages of Starman, his interests aligned with criminals. His interests aligned with the police at one point, and he mm-hmm. teamed up with the police.
Yeah.
His interests aligned with Starman and Batman, who went into Grundy's mind at one point, all of them together.
Yeah. So I think it's To me, it seems very clear that this is a version that we're getting of the Shade, is a James Robinson version. And, you know, Beth calls him out, like, he's like, let's be genteel. And she's like, you murdered Dr. Midnight. You don't deserve a genteel approach. And he just says, you know, you have no idea what you're talking about. So it's kind of curious, because looking at the flashback, it seems pretty obvious that it was a giant shadow hand that took out Dr. Midnight. But maybe there's more to the story. He does call Icicle lunatic. And then they keep pushing, you know, why are you here? He's like, I'm not being coy. It's just better if you don't know. I thought it was interesting that the Shade recognized Pat Dugan as Stripesy. So, like, he was not very secretive about his secret identity.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. I mean, he didn't wear a mask or anything, so there's that. Like, he depended on his shirt to distract people from his identity. But it did seem that Shade knew his name. It just didn't ring a bell at first.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that aside, Pat was very much more concerned that the Shade understand that he did know that was a 67 Jaguar.
Yes. I thought that was great. That was such a Pat thing.
That was almost like, it almost seemed like that was Pat's reason for undergoing this mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he just like, needed to make sure. Look,
I got to make sure that he knows that I didn't think that was a 65. I'm embarrassed about it at this point.
Yeah. All right. And then that's when Mike comes in and makes his wonderful zap wish.
Yeah. And I love the ease with which Shade took them all out.
Yep. Just a little wave of the hand. That's all he has to do.
When the Thunderbolt came at him, he didn't even look at it. He just looked down and was like, ugh, this. And took out the Thunderbolt, took everyone out. The only little amount of effort that he expended was when his shadow hands are trying to grab the staff.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell that was like maybe hurting him a little bit.
Yeah.
Or just some extreme concentration on his part to try to make anything happen there. And the staff was not having it.
Yeah. Like he knew that is what could take me down. And so I need to put all my effort into getting that away.
Yeah, because the staff kept zapping the hands away as they grabbed onto it. And that's when he looked like he was like really exerting some energy.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a good job at hiding it. So maybe the others didn't notice.
Yes. Yeah, they were a little bit distracted being, you know, forced into chairs and flipped upside down on walls and all that. And he tells them, I'm going to tell you for the last time, stay out of my way. And then he disappears into the shadows and all of them are released.
In the little denouement of this scene, Yolanda, I don't know what took her so long to do this, but she realizes, oh, I'm not the only murderer in the group. So she goes to discuss with Mike, but it doesn't really help because we learn that Mike taking out Icicle was just an accident.
Yeah.
We're really basically just lucky that it was Icicle and not like some grandma.
Yes, exactly. Also, kind of poor timing, Yolanda, because he just, you know, had a pretty big mistake that he just had.
While you're feeling down, can I talk to you about that time you murdered a dude?
Yeah, like, I understand that is just eating her away and that is all she can think about constantly. But, you know, there's a time and a place.
She needed to get it out there and this is really her first scene with Mike.
That's true.
They haven't had a lot of alone time.
And then we're back at the Whitmore Dugan home. And Mike and Courtney are on the couch and their parents are standing over them, you know, lecturing them and all that. And Courtney is just standing up for Mike. Like, you know, he's just like I was. This is a beginning. You know, this is the start of his superhero career. And I just love how supportive she is being of him.
Yeah, they're a good team. And it was reflected in the conversation they had outside the pit stop as well. The connection these two are forging is really great. And I mean, it's the show all around. Mm-hmm. It's all the connections that are being forged between people are just beautiful to watch. They just seem so earned and so real.
And I love how, like, yes, Pat and Mike, they are, you know, they're blood related. And Courtney and Barbara are. But otherwise, it's a step family. So they have been brought together. And then it's all these other people who don't have strong blood family. And so they are being brought into this. It's the idea that family doesn't end with blood. It's and make your own family.
As a stepmother yourself, I'm sure that's something that you really relate to.
Yeah, exactly. So I just love how in that the Courtney's being so great and supportive there. And then Mike pulls a mic and doesn't think about what he's going to say and just says, I wish that this was in better hands. And poof, there goes the pen.
And the pen goes to Jakeem. And I wonder if Jakeem is better hands or if it went to Jakeem because Mike previously referred to Jakeem's hands as better hands.
Oh, I just assumed that it was because that Jakeem was better because we've heard so many drops, but all those drops about him have been by Mike.
Can the Thunderbolt know who is qualified, whose better hands are, or is it just reading from Mike's brain what he thinks the better hands are?
That's interesting. I want to know so much more about the Thunderbolt.
But the scene does very much indicate that Jakeem is also very lonely.
Yeah, and his sister is a terrible human being.
I had questions about Jenny as well. Because Cindy disappeared in the middle of the school year last year.
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny was like her lieutenant mean girl.
Yeah.
So is Jenny now like big man on campus? Did she step up into the Cindy role as like chief mean girl for the school?
Oh.
Is that where she gets all this attitude?
I guess it could be. Or she's trying to prove herself to be tough at home because she doesn't have that status at school.
And mm-hmm. It may not be that important. It's just something that occurred to me.
All right. So we got Barb and Pat out on the porch. And at tells her about how Mike feels completely alone. And she's saying that's on all of us. And then very quickly moves on to not talk about how they could make things better, but instead to talk about what she found out, that the empty box that the Shade took had some kind of diamond and maybe it was a prop. And Pat says, that's no prop. That's a black diamond.
It's a very good conversation to have because maybe not everyone remembered that one scene at the end of season one.
Mm-hmm.
Where Cindy found the box.
Yes.
Or maybe they did remember the scene, but didn't recognize it as the same box.
Yes.
These things need to be made clear. And Pat's seriousness about it really rings through.
Yes. Well, and then also we need the JSA to know about, you know, the black diamond going missing, because at this point they have no idea.
Yeah, they don't know about the black diamond, but they're going to find out about Eclipso anyway in the next scene.
Yeah. Where we get, you know, Beth and Rick hanging out at the pit stop together. She's trying to reset Dr. Midnight again, and it's not going well. And so he's trying to comfort her, and she just kind of blows up, and he recognizes this isn't Beth.
Yeah, the faltering of Beth's optimism is something very of note.
Mm-hmm.
Because even while she's been going through stuff, we've had some, like, really great optimism from her.
Yes. And Rick recognizes it and he's like, okay, you can talk to me. Just pretend I'm Chuck. And like, I felt like there was like a little bit of a switch in Beth, like, okay, I can do this. I can talk. And she admits that she found the papers that her parents are divorcing. And Rick is, you know, those are just papers. You need to talk to them.
I would talk to my parents if I could.
That was a little bit of a cheap shot there, that trying to guilt her into doing something.
I feel like on the page that could have felt like a cheap shot, but the way it was delivered, it seemed more like it was caring. Like,
yes,
you
know,
you have the opportunity to talk to them. You should really do so because mm-hmm. not everybody has that opportunity. And, you know, this may be Beth realizing that she doesn't need an AI to be friends with because she does have people in her life who are happy to be her friends. I feel like the Our Night Shippers are like throwing confetti in the air at this scene.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. But even if they were going to have a moment, Chuck interrupts it because he starts talking. And it seems clear that he's still not completely back, but he says, you know, whoever this is, you're in danger. Eclipso is here.
And then we go up to the Shade on top of the American Dream Tower where our final battle with Icicle took place.
Mm-hmm.
Not Mike's final battle with Icicle, but everybody else's.
Right, right.
And he's, I don't know, sensing something from the box. The way he's touching where the diamond had been. It's almost like he can sense some residual energy. And the line of dialogue he delivers here is very curious.
Yeah, he says he's going to kill those children with like a tone of concern in his voice.
Like he's concerned about these kids.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously Eclipso is like a global threat.
Yeah.
Or at least a threat to the whole town. But his concern is for these kids.
And it's kind of a flip from the first season where all the adults were the ones being targeted by Brainwave's machine thing.
So that's the note we end on. But there is one other thing I want to point out from a selfish perspective. You know, when you watch a movie, the credits are like 15 minutes long because they put in the names of everybody involved with the production.
Mm-hmm.
TV show credits are like 12 seconds long. Obviously, they can't fit the names of everybody involved in the production. This episode, maybe the very first episode of Stargirl, first one I'm aware of anyway, that has my name in the credits.
Yay!
The very last credit screen. It's only up for literally like half a second. But if you can freeze frame, you'll see graphic artist Sean McBee.
That's great.
It made me feel so good seeing my name in the credits on Stargirl, my very favorite show.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, thanks. Now, I think we should take a quick break and come back and hear what Trey Romano has to say about being Mike Dugan and other stuff.
Stargirl After Show.
Hear ye, hear ye. Prepare thyself for a proclamation from the Dukes of Gaming.
Do you love video games? Do you love staying up to date with the latest going-ons of the gaming industry? Do you love shooting the breeze with your friends about all things interactive entertainment? Well then, fine people, do we have a podcast just for you? Join us at the Dukes of Gaming podcast. Gather around as me and my fellow Dukes bring you the most interesting news, interesting topics, and spicy hot takes from the video game realm every single Monday. If that sounds like a blast to you, subscribe to Dukes of Gaming, no questions asked. Available wherever you get your podcast.
The ad read is over.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Stargirl After Show.
So I'm here with Trey Romano, whose appearance on this podcast is honestly a little overdue, but we finally had a really mic-focused episode with 203, so we're happy to have you here, Trey.
Thanks a lot for having me, Sean.
So you are the youngest member of the cast, obviously, of the regular cast.
Yeah, definitely.
What's that experience like being the youngest of this cast of people?
It's always been pretty fun, honestly, because, you know, that's really how, number one, Luke and I hit off our, you know, friendship relationship in the first place, because, you know, there's the big chunk of cast members in the JSA that are throughout their 20s. And, you know, neither Luke and I kind of fit into that category. So that's when we started hanging out. We really bonded. But, you know, this season, season two, when we were filming, it was, you know, it was a lot of fun because I kind of got out of my comfort zone in that regard, because I have a lot more scenes with other people and things of that nature. So I really got to hang out with, you know, the other cast members a lot more, like, you know, Ange and Cameron and Hunter. You know, we all had some great episodes together and great scenes together. So, you know, I think that this season didn't make as much of a difference that I was the youngest on the cast anymore. And also, like, you know, Jakeem, who's played by Alcoya Brunson, is, you know, now on the show as well. And, you know, we had a great time doing, you know, scenes and episodes. We have some stuff later on in the season that you'll see, definitely. And, you know, it just, I think that this season, everyone in general is more comfortable with each other. and everyone just like, so, you know, it's such a family. And the fact that this season that we were doing it during COVID, that we didn't really do too much outside of seeing our cast member, like our castmates. So when we were not filming, we were still hanging out, you know? So it was definitely fun. Like I literally saw those people for 7 months straight, and that's about it. So, you know, we got really closer than we probably did in season one. But yeah, you know, being the youngest on set is, you know, it has its upsides and downsides. You know, clearly I can't like film as long, child labor laws, stuff like that, which is sometimes a blessing. Usually it is, you know, you talk to people like Breck or, you know, actually mainly Breck and, you know, also Alcoya. They're like, you know, Alcoya was doing his first, you know, night shoots this season on any show ever because he turned 18 while we were filming. Oh. So it kind of flipped a switch and I could kind of literally see it with my own eyes. It's like, okay, well, he's, you know, working his, you know, whatever, 8 hours. And then he's, you know, the next day he turns 18 and that night he's, you know, filming until 5 o'clock in the morning with, you know, the JSA. So it's just really, it was interesting seeing that. And I've always wanted to, and I did have a decent amount of night shoots this season, you know, as much as I could, you know, cause it was during, you know, what was during like the things that we were filming that I had to be doing night shoots was still kind of in summer. And if you're a child actor and it's during the summer and you don't really have school, then you know, they can push the envelope a little bit, but yeah, it was fun. We all really bonded. You know, night shoots are fun as hell. And, yeah, I'm riding out the wave of being a minor because I only have like 2 more years left until I'm going to be working like a freaking dog. So, you know, I guess I'll just,
yeah, you hit that 18, you're going to be looking back going, oh man, I miss bouncing at 8 hours.
It's freaking great. And just get in my car. It's like, see you guys. Good luck.
Now, because it is COVID, have you been back to in-person school at all since Stargirl premiered?
Actually, I've been doing homeschool for a long time at this point. I really have been kind of, you know, doing homeschool for probably 3 or 4 years at this point. But this year, funny enough that you should ask, I'm actually going back to school. Yes. I'm trying to fit it in. It's a little, artist academy, I guess you could say, in Atlanta. So it's not like public school. It's not APS, like the old days, but, you know, it's this like little academy for, you know, artists and traveling sports players and things of that nature. So I'm only going 3 days a week. So I'm going to be filming Stargirl and going there at the same time. I'm going to probably be doing a lot, honestly.
So really, suddenly being on like this massive show hasn't really affected your quote unquote childhood so much.
No, I've always tried to keep my work and my life separate, honestly, because it just, it's not worth it. You know, at some level you don't have control over it, of course, but the stuff that you do have control over when you're talking with your friends or, you know, people that, you know, the people that have known me for the longest, you know, like my childhood friends and stuff like that, who I still, you know, am very close with just because, you know, we're all great friends. Like that's never been a thing. Like they don't look at me as an actor. They just look at me as, you know, Trey from, you know, elementary school and middle school and, you know, high school. It's different. So, but you know, like which has kind of been funny over the course of being in Atlanta, you know, with like the no mask mandates and stuff like that, you can really like, I've gotten recognized quite a few times recently in Atlanta, which is actually funny, more in Atlanta than LA. Cause I was just in LA for like 2 weeks, but, yeah, it's definitely happening a lot more. And I guarantee you with season two, it's probably going to happen even more just because of Mike's relevance in the show.
What's that experience like being like recognized?
I've been recognized 3 times in Atlanta, I think, and once in LA. But the funniest time was I was in my father's restaurant, actually. And there's a guy sitting at the bar, keeps looking at me, and he comes over and he's like, "You the kid from Stargirl?" And I was like, "Yeah." I was like, he was like, "Bro, I love your character. He's so funny, man." Like, I was like, "Thanks a lot. That's you know, that's great." That was the first time I ever got recognized at all. And like, it was a funny feeling. And honestly, like you don't realize how just appreciative you feel when that happens. Initially, you know, I was, you know, like I wasn't even like, I would have, you know, I don't even know how to put it. Like when someone comes over to you and is like, "Yo, I loved your character. It was really funny. I love the show." You're just like, from the bottom of my heart, I was like, literally like, thank you for watching. Like it's more just like this thing that's not even like superficial. It's not, hey, thanks for watching. You want a picture? Da, da, da. It's just more like, hey, thanks for watching. Like I want to talk with you about this, you know? It's something that I like, I don't want to say necessarily wasn't expecting, but when it happened, I literally had like an overwhelming sense of just appreciation for the fans and for people who watch it.
That's really great. I look forward to that eroding and you just being annoyed and throwing stuff at paparazzi one day.
We'll see.
Can you talk to me a little bit about how you got involved in this show in the first place? How did Mike Dugan come to you?
This is a very fun story, actually. It all started actually on another project. If this makes any sense. I'll do a detour and I'll come back to that. But I was doing, I was about to do this movie that I was, you know, going to chemistry reads and table reads for like 8 months. And it was just a long process. I was 100% ready to do this movie. Had a great cast. And the casting director, Rich D'Elia, who was casting that movie, we got really close during that time on that film because, you know, we saw each other every week, probably, you know, we were doing table reads, chemistry reads, blah, 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 you know, the drill. Anyway, that eventually fell through with probably within like 2 weeks of filming, which was, you know, it's fine, I guess. But, you know, that right after that, Rich got the script for Stargirl and he sent it directly to me because he was like, hey, this character really seems like something that you would do, because it was almost a little reminiscent of the character that I would be playing in said movie. Because it was just really slapstick comedy, really just like quick, witty, blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay, it looks fun. You know, I thought it was just like a pilot of some sort. There was two scenes, actually. There was a scene from the pilot where, you know, Mike and Pat are walking down the street and they're talking, blah, blah, blah. And there was a scene from episode 9 or later on, I think, with Courtney when she's laying in bed and she's hurt. So there was these two like completely opposite scenes. I was like, I thought it was a comedy pilot initially. Then I read this other scene. I was like, wait, that's interesting. It's almost like a dramedy. I don't know what it was. Like since my character is not a superhero, I had no inclination that it was even a superhero show in the first place.
Right.
So yeah. And it was really interesting. And I was filming it with my good friend, Josh. And at this point I was like, hey, didn't get this movie, blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to go all for it. I'm just going to go all in.
So this is a self-tape.
This is a self-tape at this point. Yeah. I was back in Atlanta. I was like, you know, I'm just going to go all in. I'm just going to do, you know, whatever I want. So the second scene, the more dramatic scene, I was just like, Josh, who was taping me, my good friend, I was like, I'm just going to riff for a little bit. I'm just going to riff for like a minute after this. Let's see what happens. Just keep the camera rolling. Anyway, so I finished the scene. I riff for a little bit. We have some great improv, stuff like that. It ends naturally. It was like a really good scene. I was like, yeah, man, just send that. I think, you know, hopefully we'll be good. And I completely forgot about it. That was like in November of 2018, I guess. And then one night when I'm out to dinner with my family, Jeff calls. This is probably like March. And like, I did not hear about this project whatsoever for like 4 or 5 months. And then Jeff all of a sudden calls and he's like, hey, you know, it's great to have you on board. Can't wait to work with you. And I was like, what is this for? No, but it was more essentially how it was, because I was like, this is just like, it's so nuts that you hear about all these stories when actors are like, oh, I forgot that I even auditioned for it. I forgot, you know, and then it just happens and you literally just get a call at dinner with your family. And it's just like, that's just insane how it happens. And the first thing that Jeff said was that, you know, that little bit of improv that you did at the end, that's what really sold you, you know, and that's, that was special to me and like Luke. You know, because the first person that Jeff showed it to was Luke, and Luke was like, okay, this is the kid. So, because he could kind of see that we could play off each other. And a lot of that made it into season one. And a lot of it actually made it into season two, believe it or not. I always joke around with Luke. I was like, we must have like 25 hours of unused footage somewhere. It's just like floating around. Yeah, it was just really interesting. It was out of left field. And, you know, when he called, he walked me through all of Mike's character arc. The first thing he actually talked about before even season one was season two. He was like, this is what I want Mike to be like in season two. And, you know, that was what was really cool, because it started off as this slapstick 80s stereotypical annoying brother in season one. And then it kind of just like slowly takes a turn. And there was actually going to be a lot more stuff in season two than there is actually in the final product, because they pushed a lot of it to season three for COVID reasons.
It must be helpful as an actor also to know that your creators have your character's trajectory planned out, so you can get information about your character's future to inform your performance now.
I completely agree with that. And, you know, like, that's the biggest thing that I always like talk to Jeff about. So like every time you get a new script, especially like for Mike's character, Mike is ever so fastly changing. Every episode, he's slightly different. You're like peeling back layers of an onion, you know, because Mike, it's like a very shell driven character. He just is like, he hides himself in his humor and he hides himself in da da da. You know, like even episode three is literally one of the first episodes that you actually see Mike on his own dealing with bullies, dealing with this da 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 da. And you kind of see that, okay, the act is up and Mike's not probably the happiest kid on the planet. And, you know, he, you know, has his own problems and stuff like that. And it's just like really, it's just cool seeing Mike and everyone else's characters develop so much, because you know that it's planned out to a T. You know, it's like, this is none of this is random. Like, this is all leading to something else.
Now you're what, 16 now?
Yeah, I'm 16.
One thing that I've noticed about you is that you have like a supernatural amount of confidence for a 16-year-old. You seem just very comfortable, like working alongside with most of your scenes, honestly, with Luke Wilson, who's a damn legend. Was there any point where you felt sort of intimidated by all that?
I probably should have felt more intimidated than I did, honestly. I think there was this weird sense of comfort working with Luke, because growing up, I always loved his films. My father always made me watch, you know, The Royal Tenenbaums and, you know, all of Wes's films. You know, Wes is my favorite creator, probably like all time, honestly. And, you know, watching, you know, Luke from a young age and, you know, just seeing how he works and seeing like just knowing how he is, I almost felt like I knew him right when I met him. So it was this kind of overwhelming sense of just like comfort. It was the same for him for some ungodly reason. We really just hit it off and we really bonded. And, you know, he's honestly like a father to me at this point. Call him on Father's Day, call him just to check in, be like, hey, how's it going? Is everything all right? Da, da, da. It's, you know, it's, we've really kind of formed this really great relationship. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Luke and I, or just working alongside someone else, is that a lot of people, when they're in an uncomfortable situation, shelter themselves. They're like, you know, they put up walls. And with an actor, a lot of times that means not being as receptive or transparent or, you know, receptive to a scene with a scene partner. And for me, it's never been like that. You know, I'm always open for notes. I'm always open for this, for that. Every time that Luke would say something, I would just literally just take a mental note. And it was more of, you know, just respect for him as an actor and knowing how amazing he is. And, you know, like I forgot, I think it was like Chaplin who said, it takes just enough talent to give a good note to receive a good note and like, you know, actually like execute it. So I think that Luke and I, for some reason, really had a lot of respect for each other in the beginning. The first scene that we ever did, we freaking knocked it out of the park and it was amazing and it felt natural and it was fun. You know, like literally the first thing that we ever did, the first take, we just, again, started riffing. We were just like, you know, like in the middle of a scene too. It was great. We had fun and it was just, I don't know. I've honestly probably felt more intimidated without Luke, if that makes any sense, or without another actor in a scene, you know, like even with like episode three, when it was mainly just me and like, it was, you know, like doing scenes with like the bullies or some of these little guest stars and co-stars. It was amazing and fun because like, you know, you're driving that day, But at that point, you know, there's a lot of pressure on you. And Leah, I was lucky enough for episode three, Leah was just terrific. And we were finishing ahead of schedule and we were calling every day before we got to set, just being like, okay, what are we going to do? Walking through this, blah, 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 blah. And we had a great time and it was incredible. But honestly, it really does depend on the set and the environment. And if I was on another set that was more hostile and not as, you know, this, that, if I didn't have as good a connection with the cast, then yeah, I would probably have been more intimidated than I was on Stargirl.
I guess it also probably helps that Luke is very chill and unassuming. He doesn't walk around like a movie star. He's just a chill dude.
He's just too, he's too normal. It's amazing. You know, it's just like whenever we're like at dinner, like this, that, and the other, it's like very rarely work even comes up. You know, we're just talking about anything under the sun. And it's really kind of fun because you don't feel confined to be like, oh, okay, this is someone that I work with, so we're just going to talk about work. Or this is someone I do this with, so we're just going to talk about this. It's like, it's, yeah, I completely agree with that. Completely agree.
So you mentioned working with Leah Thompson as your director in this very mic heavy episode. And on season one, everybody that I talked to, whenever Leah Thompson came up, had just amazing things to say about her as a director. And talk a little bit more, if you can, about working with Leah Thompson and whether you have been a fan of her from her movies. I know you're younger. Maybe you haven't seen as many of her movies.
Yeah, I number one, I have massive respect for Leah as a director. Just coming from an actress's standpoint, that's always much needed. You can tell an actor's director and a director's director apart from each other. You know, like she breaks down things in such a way that there's two completely different mentalities.
Right. She knows what it's like on your side of the camera.
She knows exactly what it's like on my side. And the stuff that I was doing with Thunderbolt and episode 3 and stuff like that. I remember like we were, you know, it was freezing cold. It was probably like, you know, like 25 degrees like in the morning, and like this is the episode that, like, you know, the water gets poured on me, and it was just like, just I was like, that was a cluster in general, but it was fun. But you know, Leah was out there in her little you know, sweatshirt and everything. She's like, okay, come with me. She walks really fast all the time too. She's walking here, this, she's like the fastest little person in the world. You gotta like keep up with her, right? So she's walking over to where we're gonna be doing the scene on this little side street. And then she pulls out this paper and it's hand drawn all these different positions that Thunderbolt's going to be in. So then she's there acting out Thunderbolt. And I'm like, okay, this is help. Like no other director would do this, right? Like this is something that, like, it's so special and so amazing. And like the fact that I got her for my episode, like I struck gold, because like, that's like, you know, she really got everything out of that episode that she wanted to get. And she would not rest until it was 100% perfect too.
I want to know what it was like for you doing so much of the scene opposite nothing, because you have so many scenes with just the Thunderbolt.
I surprised myself. Honestly, we split that scene or those scenes into 2 days, and I had everything marked and everything, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I had initially we ran it with like a little stick with a tennis ball on it, like connected to a string.
For the eye line.
Like for the first few takes, you know, we'd swing it around and I had my eye lines and stuff like that. And after that, I kind of just memorized them. And then it was just like, okay, here, 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 here. And it was like completely choreographed, which I've never done in my life. You know, and it was just something that was very natural, because it's like, okay, you're almost counting beats. It's literally almost like you're almost literally counting tempo. Like if you're playing guitar or playing drums, it's like 1, 2, 3. Okay. Da, 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 okay. But you know, it's just like, you're constantly moving to your next position. And then along with that comes a line. And then, you know, I have, and honestly, like the person that helped me out the most in that whole entire thing was Randy Havens, who plays the school teacher, the paint teacher, or the whatever.
Mr. Diesinger.
Mr. D Singer, yes. Randy Havens helped me out the most with that, because when, you know, since Jim Gaffigan clearly was not in the state,
right?
We chose Randy just to read the sides off screen, because he's a super animated dude in general. So it just really helped. So he was like, I would read sides all day with him, and he was just great. He was just there, and he was like, it was just so fun. He's just such a great guy. Like we were, you know, he's always down to run sides with you. He's always down to, like, I don't know, but just Randy really helped me out a lot with that, because he got me into that, because his voice is so animated and so fast paced and so quick that it was just like, yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah, I can absolutely hear that.
Totally. Totally. I was like, we don't even need Jim Gaffigan. We do. Jim Gaffigan's amazing. I love Jim Gaffigan. Like,
oh, yeah, me too.
Oh my God. Like, dude, like his stuff on like Sunday morning. Yeah. But my father has always been like addicted to CBS Sunday morning. Like literally every Sunday morning we watch Sunday morning. He's like, sit down, I want you to watch this. And then, like, you know, we're watching it a little while, and then Jim Gaffigan comes on, and it's just, I love him to death. But,
so are you a fan at all of comics, or were you prior to getting into the show?
I mean, it depends, I guess. I mean, I was, you know, I always watched Marvel and DC movies growing up. Star Wars, I'm still massively into Star Wars. I love Star Wars. But, you know, I guess the only like literal book that I've ever read related to any of those things was Star Wars Aftermath, which I quite enjoyed personally. I'm just not a reader in general, and comics never really caught my eye.
So when you got that call from Jeff Johns when you were at dinner, you weren't like, oh, this is like the guy.
I did not know. And that's what Luke and I always joke around about. It's like, we're working for a mogul. We're working for a Hollywood mogul. No, but yeah, he literally is. He's like one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. And he's just like, you know, just like literally he runs the superhero game, which is insane and incredible and like amazing. But it's just, yeah, I had no idea. You know what the funny thing was? That's completely like not even related. But I saw on his IMDb that he did Robot Chicken, which like I love Robot Chicken, right? So I saw on his IMDb that he did Robot Chicken. And the first question that I had was, hey, what are the chances of you getting me on Robot Chicken? Like, because I just really want to be on an episode of that. And he was like, yeah, we'll figure that out. Anyway, back to what I was saying. So it was just more that my headspace was in a completely different arena at that point. But yeah, once I got more into the superhero stuff, like it's fun having Jeff on set because you can ask him whatever you want because he's like an encyclopedia, you know? Yeah. He makes you feel, you know, uneducated in this thing that you didn't even know that you should be educated in. You know, it's incredible. So it's like, yeah, it's just fun having Jeff around and like, you know, I'm glad that he keeps me around. But yeah, I was never really into comics that much before this.
So I know, I'm going to call you out here. I know that you didn't even read Stars and Stripe before starting to shoot season one.
This is true.
Have you read them now? Did you?
I have read them. I have. Yes. I don't want to say read them. I have scanned through them. Right. So like, I'm vaguely familiar with it now. Yes. I know there was a cosmic belt, not a cosmic staff. I know that, you know, like all that sort of stuff. Honestly, like I'm still kind of pissed off that, you know, we still have time. I'm still kind of pissed off that Mike didn't come home from military school to begin with like a buzz cut. That would have been freaking hysterical. But again, like we still have time. That might still happen. Who knows?
You know, Mike has time to misbehave enough to get sent to military school.
Exactly. Sent to military school and then like at the end of one season, then comes back the next season. It's going to be terrific.
I did read in a weird listicle thing just a few minutes ago, something about you saying that you would like to have to meet Shazam or something, or having some affinity for that character. Is that accurate?
I mean, that's not necessarily accurate. I was kind of forced into that question. Oh, what superhero would you want to meet? And I was like, I don't know, Shazam, I guess. But like, you know, so Shazam, yes, I would like to meet Shazam. Probably most out of any DC superhero.
The reason I ask that, though, is because Shazam 2 is filming right here in Atlanta.
It is.
I was wondering if you maybe called up Jeff and were like, hey, can you get me on this set?
Yeah, I've not asked Jeff yet to go on set on Shazam, but you've planted a seed in my mind that I might have to come back to.
You know, Jeff, like so many, like everything that he touches in the comics, he's like, he really revitalized and reimagined Shazam. I mean, it's Jeff is the reason the character is now called Shazam instead of Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel, he did that. Yeah. I just love that character. I love the concept of that character.
I feel like the biggest Shazam appeal really is, you know, kids read superhero comics because they want to pretend to be the superhero.
Yeah.
And Shazam has the most natural entry point for that because it's a kid that turns into a full grown superhero. So kids can be like, yeah, I could do that. I just yell a magic word and then I'm a superhero.
That makes sense. Yeah. That's a good point. I never actually really thought of it like that. But
when your name gets Googled, there's a question that comes up over and over again. And I'm fairly certain that I know the answer to this.
It's the Ray Romano question.
Yes, it's the Ray Romano question. Just put it to rest. Do you have any relation at all to Ray Romano?
I don't think so at the moment. Right. But maybe I'll be proven wrong.
You haven't done a 23andMe, but you haven't seen him at any, you haven't seen him at any family reunions.
So that's the question.
Italians have so many relatives that it might be, maybe. But at the same time, Romano is such a common last name that it's... But no, like, Ray Romano is not my father. Ray Romano is not my uncle. Ray Romano is not directly related to me that I know of. But yeah, that's, I guess, the answer to that question.
That was my assumption. But I think that people keep asking the question because Trey rhymes with Ray.
Yeah, like that, like there's, I agree with that. And like, also I feel that, like, you know, some people, like some parents name their kids slightly altered versions of their names sometimes. Like, I have a friend like that.
Well, I mean, I definitely know that your parents own a restaurant. And yes. I would have heard if Ray Romano owned a restaurant in Atlanta.
In Atlanta. Yeah, that's actually funny.
So let's talk a little bit just about episode 3 specifically, because it really is like Mike's first, like, you've had little subplots like your science fair story where Mike bonded with Barbara some more and things like that in season 1. But this is the first full on all out, like, really Mike centric episode. Did you have to do any, like, extra preparation for being the center of an episode?
Number one, I got the script very early, so I was very prepared for it. You know, I was reading episode 3 when I was filming episode 1. So I had a lot of time to really, like, perfect it and really, you know exactly how I wanted to convey Mike, because I knew it was that important. I knew I wanted Mike to be likable for the rest of the season. And this is the, you know, the first episode that we really see him solely. So it's like, okay, this is really going to determine how the audience looks at Mike for the rest of the season. So I really just wanted to absolutely, like, nail it. And again, a lot of help from Leah Thompson, because that was when we worked together last season. We only had probably a few scenes together. And that's what she was like. She was like, hey, give me a call if you need anything, blah, blah, blah. So we were reading through the script together just to really hammer out what exactly we wanted weeks and weeks before shooting. So we were on the exact same page. We were on the exact same, you know, everything. We were on, we knew exactly collectively, like, where Mike would be sitting in a certain, like a certain scene, or where Mike would be standing in this or that, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like everything was completely planned out to a T. And that's why we were so ahead of schedule. And that's why we were so, you know, it was just, it went so much better than any of us could have expected. And, you know, like, I really went into a trance, honestly. I literally went, the 2 or 3 weeks that we were filming that, I was literally like work, 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 work. It was just 100%. Like, I just shut down everything else in my life. It was just this, you know, and it was, you know, I was barely talking on set. I was barely doing X, Y, Z. And it was a great feeling, because when you're that dialed in, you're just like, there's this almost kind of feeling of, you know, I don't even know how to describe it, but when you're in this groove constantly for weeks on end, it's almost like you mentally can do no wrong. If that makes any sense, because like you're so familiar with the script at this point. You're so completely entranced in it. That every single day, it's not like, oh, I need to memorize a scene. Da, 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 da. No, it's done. It's ready. I'm ready to churn it out.
And so you worked super, super hard in order to properly portray a kid who really is not into working very hard.
I cannot say it much better myself. Yes.
Mike just seems so natural for a kid that also kind of seems like a 40-year-old in a child's body. I don't know. Yeah. It just seems really effortless for you.
Yeah. I think that Mike has changed along with me as I've grown. And, you know, like, we've had a lot of time in between season 1 and season 2, as we all know.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just saw a picture from season 1 earlier today. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't realize like how much different he looked. Like, your forehead was so much bigger in relation to your face.
I know. I completely agree with that. And I think that's a very accurate statement. Thanks for pointing it out, Sean. Really. Like, I hope when everyone goes back and watches season 1, hey, remember what Sean said about Trey's forehead?
Now, well, it's really not that you had a giant forehead. It was just that I noticed that looking at my like freshman yearbook, like everybody, like their foreheads just shrink between freshman and sophomore year. Just something about that thing, age. Honestly.
It's a beautiful thing. Forehead shrinkage is godly.
You just look like you've aged like 6 years. You're like almost an adult now. And then you like just seemed like you were, I don't know, 10 or something. It was.
I really did seem really young in that. And also it was how like the character was portrayed. And like, I forgot how like deep my voice got. Like, when I was watching like season one, like it was just like, I was a baby, man. Honestly, we all were. We were all freaking babies. Like I was watching, you know, like Cameron and like, you know, okay, for some reason, especially Cameron looked like a child, a damn child when filming season one. And I not even joking, when I was out in LA, I hung out with them every single day. Like we're starting a band, by the way.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. We're starting a band, Cameron and I, but yeah, like I literally,
whoa, hold on, man. What's the name? You got to have a cool band name.
The working title is Traveling Trey and Cool Hand Cam.
I said you needed a good band name.
Okay, Sean. I let's save it. You're not invited. You know, I was gonna invite you to opening night, but I don't know anymore. After that, Traveling Trey and Cool Hand Cam. You don't understand how much thought we put into that. It definitely did not just, you know, come out of nowhere and we just went with it because we can't think of anything better. That's definitely not what happened. But you know, I will not take our band slander anymore. But yeah, we are starting a band.
It is weird because we're like 6 months after season one in story wise, but we're fully 2 years on.
Oh yeah. That's the funny part. And it's like, did I ever really look like I was a year younger than Breck? No, I never did. I looked like I was just a little child and Breck is a year older than me. But now it looks a little bit more realistic that I'm still just a year younger than her.
To be fair, Breck does look a lot younger than she is.
Oh, definitely. Like she can easily be 16.
Right.
Easily. Which she is, I think, in the show. But yeah, I completely concur about like the time change. And it's just like, that's why I was even so shocked that people even recognized me in the first place. I'm like, how do you recognize me first from season one? It's just like, I don't know. But yeah, you know, the time off that we had to kind of look back at, you know, season one and what we wanted to do differently and stuff like that, I think really helped all of our performances in general. We had so much time to reflect on what we actually wanted our characters to be like, which is fantastic, honestly. And, you know, that's been a big talking point with even, you know, just Cam and I just talking about what we've always wanted to change about our characters and what has changed and, you know, what Jeff has picked on, up on that he's, you know, changed dialogue wise or story wise, you know. As scripts keep getting written and as the story keeps going, you can kind of tell the writer's room picking up your own mannerisms and your own form of speaking and your own, you know, it's just like, you know, as the season, as the show started, all of our dialogue was kind of crisp. And then now it's kind of mellowed out and it seems really natural and human, which is great. And, you know, that's, and it's like that with every show. Every show has that little breaking in period. It's like breaking in a baseball glove, you know, just like as the seasons go on, dialogue gets, you know, smoother. Like the characters are more in tune with each other. The writer's room knows the actors better. And I think some time off really helped all of that because everyone was like, okay, get your heads back in the game. What do we want to change? What do we want to do differently? Blah, blah, blah. And it just made season two and our performances just that much better.
Yeah, because... I feel like for the writers, it must be a lot easier for a season two because you're writing a character in season one, but you don't really know the character because you don't know what the actors are bringing to them.
Exactly.
But now, after 13 episodes of seeing you guys bring the characters to life and put your own breath into them, now the writers have somewhere to go.
Precisely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, that's the thing. You almost like you can look at all these iconic shows like Breaking Bad or Sopranos or any of that they all had that breaking in period.
And it's good that you were able to sort of over such a long break between seasons to refine your character. Whereas I feel like there's almost with a big gap like that, there's almost a risk of sort of becoming a caricature of the character.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've seen that happen on movies like sequels, where a character comes back. Let's say Christian Bale's Batman. He had the gravelly voice in Batman Begins, and then in Dark Knight, it's so over the top, the gravelly voice, that it's almost like a caricature. Like, he forgot what he did and was just recreating it and
trying to replicate it. Yeah, exactly. And like, then again, that's the type of lull that writers' rooms get into. They get a type of lull. It's like, okay, well, this sounds cool, this looks cool, blah, blah, blah. And it just becomes like an homage to the original project, in the sense that, you know, like, it's just, you're like, after a season or of a show or after a movie, everything becomes about fan service. Everything's about, you know, like, what's going to appeal to the audience, about what's going to... Stargirl's not like that. It's a completely 100% character driven creative show. You know, it's not about, okay, so it's clearly about like the characters, like how, where Mike's going to go, where all the characters are going to go, but it's more honestly about the actors, which is incredible, because that these actors have changed as actors, and now we can push them farther, or now we can pull them back, or now we can do this, blah, 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 blah. We're like little chess pieces, you know, and it's great.
It's just a really magic show, especially for a superhero thing, because superhero stuff is so often focused on like just the next big fight scene, and how do we get to the next big fight scene? But all of this is the character driven stuff is just magical. And it's because we have Jeff and James in the writer's room.
Jeff and James make this all possible. Like this, I mean, clearly they make it all possible because they're creators, but like to an extent that a lot of people fail to even realize how talented they are, and how it's almost like they're telling their own story. It's almost like they're telling, I mean, they are telling their own story, but when I say like, it's almost like an autobiography of some sort. So they've grown up with this story, and they've not even grown up with the story. They've literally curated this story from when they were young, and they can literally just spew all of it on screen and it'd be organic and amazing, because like they're not holding back whatsoever. It's like everything that I see in my head is going to be on the screen, and it's just like an incredible, it's incredible they have the resources to do it, and it's incredible that, you know, we're still in the position that we're doing it
now. I will let you go soon, but I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the relationship between Mike and Courtney. And I want to know how you and Breck like built that relationship up.
Well, we both have siblings. We both grew up with siblings, of course, since we both have siblings. And it's the relationship almost like, you know, me and Luke's very father-like relationship. Our relationship has always been very sibling-y, if that makes any sense. Just like, it's this, like, I don't know, we really have respect for each other just as actors, and as, you know, and it's almost like we know exactly what both of our characters are, and we know exactly, like, we're very in tune with our characters. And I feel that when we're doing these sister-brother scenes, whatever the hell you want to call them, you know, it just conveys really well on screen that, you know, we really do have like a lot of respect for each other, and we can kind of manipulate that into a little bit of jealousy. You can manipulate that into whatever you want to, but like this season really is focused on the respect aspect. It's more that, you know, these two people are in very similar situations. You know, Breck's character was in the same situation that Mike is in this season. They're both trying to find their legacy. They're both trying to find, you know, where they belong in life. So it's, you know, Breck and I really just brought that to the table, in the sense that we both know, like, you know, we both know how many conversations we've probably had with our siblings about this type of stuff. We both probably, you know, it's probably not as high stakes as superheroes saving the world, but, you know, it's applicable. So I think that it just, also the way it's written, it's very transparent, very real. You know, it's very, you know, it feels like it's something that you could, again, like I said, literally think of. You could take an argument with your sibling, you could take a conversation with your sibling and put it on paper, and it'd be just as organic as it is on screen. So yeah, you know, Breck and I were just really blessed with having great dialogue and great scenes. And, you know, like, especially like in episode three, there's that cool scene outside of the pit stop that I think was really good. And it looked good. And
the voting him into the JSA.
Yeah. Discussion. Yeah. That's a really special scene to me. I just think that, you know, we were just really lucky to have lucked out with as good of preparation and as much respect that we have for each other to really apply it to those type of scenes.
Yeah. It's been a really great arc because, you know, in the pilot, you guys barely know each other. And you're forced into this life together and you bond over time. And then there were like the whole aspect of watching this new sister bond with your father in a way that you are not able to, while then Mike, you know, bonds with Barbara in a really great way. And it's just been beautiful to watch, and you guys both are killing it, and it's so naturalistic. And by the way, I did an interview with Andy Armiganian yesterday, and she specifically told me to tell you that she loved what you did and that you were amazing in the episodes she directed.
I wish I could tell her thank you very much, because I had a great time doing those episodes with Andy. Yeah, the episodes that she's probably referring to are like episode 8 and 9, I think. And those episodes are just like, wow. Especially episode 9. Can't wait until you guys watch episode 9. Because that's like some different stuff.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to that. The last half of the season, I can't wait to see it. I've only seen the first half right now, but I know everything that happens in the last half, and I just need it in my eyeballs.
Yeah, I need it in my eyeballs too. I'm actually really, dude, Hunter Sansone absolutely crushed episode 9. Like nothing I've seen. He is just, I'm so glad that he had screen time this season a lot more, but you know, just like with, especially with episode 9, like he just absolutely knocked that out of the park. Beautiful work. Absolutely beautiful work.
Yeah. I think episode 9 probably is going to be like the biggest standout of the whole season.
I agree with that. Just everyone's performance is stellar. Literally everyone's performance is top notch. Luke's performance, incredible. Amy's performance, incredible.
Well, Trey, thanks so much for being with us here on Stargirl After Show. Do you have any parting words for our audience?
Just, you know, I'm looking forward to everyone seeing season 2. I think it's going to knock your socks off. You'll see some really great character development. You'll see your favorite characters, you know, really grow into things that you probably wouldn't expect. And yeah, it's a really, really fulfilling, really exciting season. I can't wait for you guys to see it.
Girl After Show.
This kid just impresses me. I didn't realize that he was the only one that was under, you know, the 18 years of age. And so that he's, you know, doing school and he's working so hard to do all this stuff. And then just counting, he seems like a very prominent part of the show too. So it seems strange that he isn't old enough to film as much as everyone else.
Yeah, especially this season.
I loved hearing about like the inside perspective and how that all works. And then just, I think it's better that we talk to him this season instead of first season, because his role has shifted and gotten so much bigger now.
Yeah.
He had a lot more to talk about.
You know, this is the best episode for Mike so far.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He's absolutely front and center in it. And in season 1, he was a great side character. Mm-hmm. But he never got to be really front and center.
Yeah, and Trey showed that he absolutely has the skills to be a front and center actor.
Absolutely.
He did an amazing job in this episode.
And his interview was like, he was just so thoughtful and his answers so considered.
Mm-hmm.
He just boggles my imagination for a 16-year-old to be so put together.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, hearing him talk, I would think that he's much older.
That's it. That's our episode, guys. Hope you've enjoyed. Don't forget to tag us with So Cool. All caps, please. At least one exclamation point. at StarGirlPod on Twitter if you want your free Thunderbolt pen. And feel free to check out our other shows and this show and plenty of other shows at FandomLimb.com, the home of Fandom Limb Media, the podcast family we belong to.
Yeah, there's tons of great content out there. Among others, you can listen to Sean's other podcast, Table Reads.
And Sarah's other podcast, What's New, Nancy Drew.
And I gotta say, I'm very excited. Ben and I just got to interview the actor who plays Tom Swift, Tian Richards. And so definitely go check out that episode.
Very nice. Congrats.
Thanks. He is an amazing human being. Just
fantastic. All right, guys. Do that. Go check out all the shows on FandomLimb.com. Like and review us if you would care to do so, please. And always feel free to reach out to us on any of our socials. Instagram and Twitter are at StarGirlPod. And you can always find our email on StarGirlAftershow.com. So we will see you next week, where we will have a double interview with Neil Hopkins and Joy Osmonsky.
Oh, great.
Tigress and Sportsmaster themselves. So stay tuned for that next week. And until then, have a super great day.
Stargirl After Show is a production of Fandom Limb Media.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.